Well, I'll introduce our panel tonight. Next to me is the Ambassador for Bulgaria, His Excellency Krešimir Stefanov. Besides him is the Ambassador for Spain, His Excellency Enrique Figuera. And beside him is Noel Campbell. He's the Official Secretary and Chief of Staff for the New South Wales Governor. He's on loan from the Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade, and he's on loan back to Canberra for tonight. He has previously been the Australian Ambassador to Spain, as well as to Yugoslavia, when that nation existed as an entity, and the United Arab Emirates, I think. In Australia, we don't have the tradition of calling former ambassadors ambassador till the day they die, as they do in the United States. but you've certainly earned that title. Well, we're celebrating the 50 years of formal relations. 50 years ago, Australia sent an ambassador to the EEC. An interesting perspective on that, of course, is that that did mark a change of relations, not only of Australia with Europe, but Australia with Britain. I remember Malcolm Fraser in the Republic referendum telling the story how Australia was a bit miffed that when Britain joined the common market, the European, the forerunner, of course, the European Union, we lost some of our preferential trade deals with Britain. And he sent the Deputy Prime Minister, who's also the Trade Minister, Doug Anthony, off to London, only to be told by Her Majesty's government in London that Britain very much saw its future in Europe and that Australia should see its future maybe in Asia. I'm quoting Malcolm Fraser now. And apparently that was the seminal moment for Malcolm Fraser to become a Republican. Anyhow, 50 years down the track, we do have a very important relationship with the European Union and with its constituent states, and tonight, or this afternoon, we'll explore some more of that. What I might do at first is, as it were, get a scene-setting statement from our panel. So if I go first to you, Krešimir, why is your country a member of the European Union, and what do you think that means in terms of your country's relations then out to Australia?
I can point out several factors that drove us to EU membership, but I think one of the most decisive is the feeling of belonging. My Czech colleague some time ago here said that Prague is to the west of Vienna, so there was no doubt where the Czech Republic should be now, and he's right. Prague and Vienna are Europe. But Europe doesn't end there. Bulgaria is, I think not many of you know that Bulgaria is one of the oldest European countries, dating back more than 1,300 years ago under this very name, never changed its name. Historically and culturally, it has always been part of Europe, and it's after its liberation in 1878, Bulgaria adopted a constitution which was influenced by the Belgian constitution and was assessed by contemporaries as one of the most progressive democratic constitutions in Europe at that time. Until the Second World War, almost the entire Bulgarian economy was turned to the West and had a GDP, annual GDP growth of more than 6%. Of course, after the war, the communist regime changed the path of the country. The democratic changes in 1989 and the disintegration of the Soviet bloc gave the Bulgarians the option to choose their destiny, and I can tell you that the majority, especially the younger generation, had no hesitation whatsoever about which way to choose. As I said, the European feeling and the attractiveness of the European project offering a lot of advantages, a lot more opportunities for people, and seen as a guarantor for security and irreversibility of the process, was the driving force to our membership to the European Union. And it is indicative that in 1992, 82% of the Bulgarians were supporting EU membership, which is a very high percentage. So in few words, in 1990 we signed an association and trade and association agreement with the EEC, the European Economic Community. 3 years later we signed an association agreement. The membership application was filed in 1995, the end of 1995. 3 years later the negotiations began, and in 2007 Bulgaria became a member of the EU. But unfortunately, I should explain why we joined a bit later. Unfortunately, the transition from communism to democracy wasn't as smooth and quick as we all wanted. It had its political, mostly political setbacks. Economic, of course, too, but mostly political. It was not a result of revolutionary events that happened in, for example, in Poland, in Czechoslovakia, at that time Hungary. In 1989, some members of the Bulgarian Communist Party, who saw the inevitable, carried out a de facto coup d'etat, declared themselves socialists, and did their best, actually, to slow down the process in order to gain time to transform their former political power into economic power. So that explains to a great extent why we joined sometime later than the other new members, and some of the problems that we still face.
Thanks for that. We'll come back to the relationship to Australia. Thanks for that scene setter. So coming to Spain, interestingly, Spain, of course, joined the EU the community in 1986. And while you, unlike Bulgaria, didn't come from a communist bloc country, one could argue that it took the end of the Franco dictatorship for Spain to then emerge as a modern country.
Well, yes. There was also a negotiation leading to a sort of a commercial agreement with the European Union, the European Community at that time, very early. But negotiations to become a full member, took quite a longer time, because the Spanish economy is, even if it was backward at that time, we're speaking about 1975, it's quite complex and quite wide. And there were several packages dealt within the accession negotiations, and there were different transition periods on different sectors which could create problems to the European communities later on agriculture, fisheries, steel, and all these sorts of things. Well, finally, the agreement was reached. It took 7 years to negotiate. It's a long, long negotiating process, perhaps the longest ever acceding member state, but finally the result is there. I mean, we turn from a protectionist, autarkic country economy to a very open, competitive economy in a short period of time. Of course, there were some social consequences. The high unemployment rate we have experienced all around these years come precisely from that time. There have never been below 10% of unemployment rate in Spain, and it comes precisely at that time where there were too many people employed in the countryside. But the result is there. I mean, the consequences were fantastic. Spain in 25 years was able to become the 10th economy in the world. That's great. I have to say that we have received a lot of from the European Union, from the European communities, and this was also the effort of Spanish negotiators who, during all these years, have also shaped European institutions, European policies, also to the interest of the Spanish state and interest. In this sense, for example, I could put several examples, like, for example, the idea of European citizenship, which is very dear to Spain, because we value very much the linkage with people. Spain is, I think, the European member country who received more visitors from European member countries, from all European member countries. We also have the largest number of permanent residents from member countries. And we also have the largest number of Erasmus students in Spain, so more than in any other member country in Europe. So we are very much a recipient country, and we like it very much to be. So we cherish very much the idea of European citizenship, to work towards an idea to go beyond our national borders. The same I could mention with the regional policy, the cohesion fund, which is now, or the cohesion policy, which is now so important for the new member countries. There are billions of euros which has been invested in Spain in the last few years. We have become, together with the Common Agricultural Policy, one of the first recipients of structural funds and cohesion funds and social funds and these funds, which explain also that in these years we have been able to create the widest resource of transport network in Europe and the world, perhaps.
Thanks for that. Coming to you, Noel, 50 years ago Australia had entered into a formal relationship with the European Commission. Was this in any way, well, obviously it was just facing up to reality. How do you see that from the perspective of Australia's place in the world, of Australia's relationship with the European countries?
Well, as we have said before, the relationship with Europe goes back many years. It's a relationship based on our history. We look to Europe as the cradle of democracy. We look to Europe as the source of the Industrial Revolution, the Renaissance, and a primary source of immigrants over the years. I think we got a big surprise, clearly, when the United Kingdom decided to join the then EEC. But that, I think, was a lesson to us and was actually a very salutary thing to have occurred, because we had to take a really close look at our own economic competitiveness, our own economic profile. And I think as a result of that step of the UK joining the EEC, we benefited greatly in an economic sense. I think it's also, however, a relationship that has evolved and developed over the last 50 years. At the beginning, you may recall, we were fixated almost to the exclusion of all else about the common agricultural policy. It's still an irritant in the relationship, but it's not an issue that holds hostage all of the other elements of the relationship, which are many. I think by any measure, Europe is still important to Australia. It is our second largest trading partner in terms of exports. As a bloc, it's our single greatest source of investment, and it's also our greatest investment destination. But even more than the economic relationship, it involves people-to-people relations, migration, students, tourism, science, technology, innovation. It is something that covers a whole gamut of issues that, as I say, is evolving from what it was 50 years ago, and in my view, in a very positive way.
I think if we could broaden the discussion now, or narrow in one sense the discussion now to what Europe and indeed the rest of the world is dealing with, namely the aftermath of a global financial crisis. And some would argue that maybe there's not much aftermath yet. Maybe we're still going through a crisis in some way or another. And if I could come to you, Enrique, we know that Greece is having a particular impact not only on perceptions of what's happening, particularly with the Eurozone, but also is seen by some as symptomatic of the problems with the Eurozone. And then you mention Greece and people immediately say, and then you've got Portugal, then you've got Spain, then you've got Italy. So what's your perspective on how Spain fits into this sort of discussion, this sort of perspective?
Well, yes, this is a main issue today, isn't it? It's hitting the headlines every day, and we're seeing how the European leaders is trying to cope with this situation, which is also new for us. And this is partly the reason why it takes some time to resolve, giving also the burdensome procedures of the European Union. We are not a state. We are not a super state either, although we have some institutions like the European Central Bank, which is really behaving like with a lot of flexibility and a lot of action-driven initiatives. But we are not a super state, and all decisions have to be tested, have to be proved, have to be implemented, and by 27 member countries. And this sometimes is difficult. It requires time, which, I mean, given the importance of the things at stake, given the importance of the euro, it is understandable that many countries lose a bit patient with the time we are losing discussing so many things. But this is how things work in Europe. As we have seen in the past few terms, the leaders are trying to resolve the issues as they come. Now we have also political developments in different European member countries, and it is perhaps somehow easy to compare the situations of one country with the others, but there are quite a big differences. Speaking about the case of Greece, and I don't want to say what's going to happen, but I have the confidence that the European leaders as well, particularly the Greek government, will be able to solve this situation, will be present. And also the some other governments with difficulties like Ireland, Portugal, Italy, or even Spain. In the case of Spain, I can tell you that our problem comes basically for the real estate bubble, which burst sadly in 2008 and took us by surprise. The then government, socialist government, reacted with a sort of a classical Keynesian policy, very much trying to increase demand by spending a lot of money, and it took our budgetary deficit to 11%. This was considered very high at the moment, where Europe, most of the important European economies was doing a real effort in trying to make a fiscal consolidation. And with the general elections last year, with the new Conservative government, absolute majority, new measures have been taken towards fiscal consolidation, and the idea is that the 6% deficit we have now will go down in 2014 to 3%.
Indeed, the austerity measures taken by the new government, as you say, are working. How are they being received?
Well, badly, because they have a lot of social consequences. Mm. And nobody wants to be taking up money. Civil servants, for example, education, health, they have been cut a bit everywhere. Not only that, but also taxes have been increased, indirect taxes and so on. There have been a partial bailout for bankings. There will be a bad bank created. There is a new measures to try to foster rental market on top of real estate market, which is also most of the Spanish people like to live in the house they buy, I mean their owner. So rental markets need to be very much developed. But of course, the main issue here is the perception of the market about the ability of the Spanish state to face the debt. And this is the main issue at stake right now, because the interests are very, very high, as you know. And I mean, we were able to return the money and to face this interest for a number of some time, but up to a certain point, it would be impossible. So this is the reason why Spanish authority has been very vocal in order to push the European Central Bank, which has many means, to try to control this high interest.
Chris Amir, Bulgaria is not a member of the Eurozone yet. Does it want to be? Is there a lesson for Bulgaria from Greece? Some economists say that Greece would be able to handle its affairs better if it didn't have some of the constraints now being imposed on it by the European Central Bank. What's the Bulgarian view of this?
Well, the crisis in the Eurozone no doubt affects all member states. Bulgaria is not a member of the Eurozone, as you said, but for the last 15 years, the Bulgarian currency, the lev, has been bound first to the German mark and later to the euro. And the exchange rate is fixed. So far, the country has managed to avoid most of the problems that other member states have. And I will say it here, according to a report of Fitch Ratings Agency, published last July, Bulgaria has achieved successful fiscal consolidation, stable monetary policy, and rebalancing the economy. And the expected growth of GDP for this year is 0.9, with expectations to reach 2.5, 2.6 in 2014. Well, at the moment, as it looks, Bulgaria is one of the very few countries that meet the Maastricht criteria for the common currency. But we are an applicant country. We have not set up a timetable to introduce the euro for the moment.
Is there support for
Greece?
In Bulgaria itself, do people want to join the Eurozone?
I can't say at the time.
Is it controversial?
It is a bit controversial now, as I said, we will not. In fact, we feel like we have joined the Eurozone because we're dealing with euro. The exchange rate is fixed, as I said. So. Practically, if we join the Eurozone, we don't expect any internal concussions, on the market or something. I wanted to say that still, as the situation looks pretty good for the moment, Bulgaria is still exposed to the problems in the Eurozone through financial channels, because subsidiaries owned by Greek parent banks still play a significant role in the Bulgarian banking sector. And an exit of Greece from the Eurozone, which, is being accepted in one way or another, will definitely have repercussions in Bulgaria. Against this, the banking sector has accumulated capital of above the regulatory minimum, but still Bulgaria is exposed.
Noel, as a former Australian ambassador in Europe, especially to Spain, now back in Australia, would you say, and maybe it could be for crass domestic political purposes, but there seems to be a view abroad that that Europe is something of a basket case and isn't as important to us as China, for example?
I think a little like Mark Twain once famously said, the rumours about my death are grossly exaggerated. I think the same could be said of the EU and the Eurozone. As I mentioned, my first intervention, Europe is still immensely important to us economically, socially, politically, and will continue to do so. I think it's a mistake and perhaps misleading to give the impression that there's a choice. It's either Europe or the Asia-Pacific. I think very clearly in the case of Australia, it's been an evolving process, the conclusion of which is we can do both. It's in our interests to have a strong Europe. It's in our interests to explore new and emerging markets such as Asia, China, the Middle East, where I once served, and indeed Latin America, where I also once served. So trying to imagine that Europe is a basket case and therefore is of less importance to Australia, I think, is exceedingly wrong. If I might just take up the points that Enrique was making about the austerity program, I think this underlines an important debate within Europe that we are obviously following closely in Australia, and that's the debate between austerity on the one hand, an approach obviously that's supported by Northern European countries, shall we say, and the question of the need to stimulate growth as well in order to help get out of the current troubles, which is an approach obviously taken by countries like France and Italy. I think it's misleading to only talk about austerity when there is the argument that we need stimulus as well. And whilst I've got the floor, let me make one final observation. I think that it's very important to look to the future. Europe has been around for a long time. The European Union has been around for a long time. It's also been in a process of evolution. And the high point, if you like, was probably the 2009 Lisbon Treaty. We've talked about individual member states, but let's also take note of the fact that many of the policies and institutions have indeed been much more closely aligned and integrated. And this, I think, has been one of the conclusions of 50 years of experience.
There seems to be a view, maybe this view comes from across the other side of the Alps, especially, say, in Germany, that that Germans work hard and have achieved much success through discipline and through being spendthrift, whereas those southern Europeans tend to have a good life and expect us to bail them out all the time. Now, I'm a bit prejudiced here. My heritage is clearly Italian, and so I have some sympathy with the Spanish here, because I don't think it's well understood by many. I probably exclude this audience here tonight, that in fact Spain, the Spanish have worked very hard, as you were saying earlier, to bring their country to prosperity, only to see, of course, the housing bubble burst. What do you make of this view, though, that southern Europeans have got the terrific wine, the tapas and the sunshine, and therefore, therefore unlike the Germans, they don't want to work too hard?
Well, yeah, including in all countries in Europe, there are also these misconceptions that and prejudices, as you said, that suddenly when we are facing a crisis where there are some countries doing well and some others doing badly, these prejudices are raising once again. No one spoke about Germany when they had this budget deficit in the beginning of the 2000s. But Germany was doing its work, and this is what we should have been doing at the time as well. And if we are this way now, it's because we haven't done that job before. So, no, misconceptions and prejudices are everywhere. But I don't think that, on the contrary, I've read polls stating that Greeks actually work more than Germans, more hours than Germans. Spanish people inventing the siesta actually sleep less than the rest of the world.
They go to bed later, I know.
Perhaps we are partying all the time. I don't know. Yes, this is these are prejudices that one have to cope here and there. But one important question, and I feel very, very, very much for Europe and the European integration. When you look back to the last 10 to 15 years, and you see what Europe has been able to do, starting with the single market, the Maastricht Treaty with the three pillars, the common security and foreign policy, the justice and home affairs issues, the European Monetary Union, although we have these problems today, then the Amsterdam Treaty, the Nice Treaty, the Lisbon Treaty, now the all the governance. I mean, this is not going to stop. The idea is what the foreign ministers the other day said. Some more foreign ministers will get together in Europe and speak about the future of Europe. They said that the matter at stake here is the irreversibility of the European Union and the irreversibility of the euro. And this is the fact. I mean, the question is that markets sometimes do not realize that the European Monetary Union is a political action. And it remains to be very much political. So if I were an investor, I mean, at the end of the day, to invest against the European Union, the collapse of the European Union, the euro, this is very, very risky because there is the political will behind. There are many, many years at stake. There are many countries who are really fighting to get a single European Union. And, I mean, after all, the euro has been very well for all of us. I've seen latest comments and polls in Europe, and the majority of businessmen acknowledge that euro has been very positive for all business. So we have to try to look at the situation, and I'm sure that we'll cope situation.
Well, Krasimir, we know that Bulgaria is well and truly north of the Alps, but as you were saying before, Bulgaria in many ways is tied into the Greek banking system. Is there a view in Bulgaria about southern Europe in terms of how the how it might affect the way the union can move forward? Well, maybe my question is shaped by prejudices from from Australia, which is well and truly south of the Alps, and that is that the problem of the EU and the Eurozone seems to be a problem more of southern Europe. You know, that's what.
No, as I mentioned before, I think that the problems in the Eurozone affect all the member states, and all the member states should exert efforts to overcome this crisis. For our contribution for the moment, as I said, is that we are not in the focus of the light. We are not a burden for the European Union, not a point of discussion. So I think this is, for the moment, this is what we are doing in favor of the European Union. As I said, we may live modestly, but we spend our own money. So... that is the situation, as I said, is rather stable. But I think that, as Enrique said, the euro is irreversible. And this was confirmed yesterday by Herman Van Rompuy with the talks with the Spanish Prime Minister. And that means that European Union is irreversible. So... whoever, as you said, is betting against this, I think he will lose, because this is not the first time that the European Union has been in crisis, and every time it got out stronger. So I am convinced that this will be overcome, and the euro will stay, and Greece will be in the eurozone. And for Spain especially, I have no doubt this is a big economy, this is a big country, that they will manage to overcome the crisis.
Well, certainly it's in the interest of the international financial system that your optimism is founded on, you know, on a good basis, which brings me to an issue that's going at the moment. Yesterday, our government announced that it was linking our carbon market to the European carbon market. Our opposition leader said that, well, Europe isn't the world. The government, of course, says, well, this is linking us into the world, and pointed out that there's a $200 billion carbon market and that there are 500 million people in Europe. This development, maybe if I could go to you, Noel, is it Is it the linking Australia in more firmly, or is this just an example of how Australia is, in fact, tied to Europe?
I take the latter view, and I also see it in the broader context of the future of the Australia-Europe relationship. This is an example of greater integration. It's an example of drawing on the experience of Europe, which has many years of an ETS being in place. And as you said, it is indeed the greatest single carbon market. So I think it's in both our interests clearly that this happen. But the broader question of integrating more closely the relationship, I think, has evolved over the years. It's one that is a multifaceted relationship. Trade, investment, yes, but also some of the other elements that are increasingly important. Increased engagement on multilateral issues, from disarmament to climate change, as you just mentioned, to human rights, to non-proliferation. It's hard to imagine a bloc of countries with whom we have closer political interests and with whom we work most closely in multilateral fora. So I see the ETS and the closer engagement on that issue is simply part of a broader raft of issues on which we cooperate closely already and will continue to intensify in the future.
Enrique, as the Spanish ambassador, no doubt you've taken notice of the political discussion in this country. For example, there is a view that apparently is accepted as maybe a reasonable view that climate change, or at least anthropogenic climate change, isn't real, and this is colouring some of the debate we have. Now, Spain, of course, in many ways could parallel Australia. It is a fairly big country that is quite dry and also has the challenge then of how it deals with the whole issue of climate change. How has Spain dealt with it?
Well, before answering to your question, I think that coming back to the comments of Neil, I think that because we share the same principles and values and we have a very similar view on international politics, Europe and Australia are not that different, you know, when you come to looking at global problems, and climate change may be one of them. Our philosophy is very, very close. Or there may be some details here and there. Of course, in my own country, I don't want to go into the discussion here in Australia, which I follow very interestingly. But in Spain also there are some nuances between the conservatives and the socialists. Yeah. But no one denies the existence of climate change and the need to participate in international negotiation to try to find solutions in order to cope with it. So Spain have participated in the development of the European scheme since the very beginning, but it is not a political issue, has never been a political issue, as here. Perhaps because there is more, how would you put it, conscientiousness due to the fact that our politicians are obliged to work together with other European politicians, which more or less, share the same philosophy in this respect.
But Spain has invested heavily, has it not, in renewable energy?
Exactly. It's a real pity that there are some parts of our policies, like, for example, energy policy, which is not still developed within the European Union context. I say still, because there are some provisions already in Lisbon, and according to what we have reading recently, there is a lot of political will to develop this energy policy issues, which, like defence or foreign policy, touches really the core of the national competence of member states. And I'm very happy because some member states, like Germany, for example, Denmark, now also Britain and France and Italy, of course, and Spain, we have put a lot of resources lately in developing essential renewable energies, wind and sun, which, by the way, I think that will be fantastic here in Sweden and in Australia. And we are also already cooperating a lot in this respect. So I'm happy to see that in the new proposals put forward by our Minister of Foreign Affairs in order to work closer in different policies, energy is particularly one of them.
Okay, thank you. Bulgaria historically has relied on nuclear power for electricity. Is this not so? What's the Bulgarian view of the discussion on climate change and what we should or shouldn't do about it?
Yes, you're right. For many years, we were developing the nuclear power, and we had, if I'm not mistaken, about 22% of the energy produced in Bulgaria was coming from nuclear plants. Actually, it was one big nuclear plant with six units. We had to close four of them when we were negotiating our membership with the union, because they, all of them, especially the four that we closed, are of Russian-made. And were comparatively old as a make for as years, but we spent a lot of money to modernize all these reactors, a huge amount of money, and it was proven that they could work safely still some more years. But as I said, one of the conditions for our membership was to close the old reactors. So. We are now turning also towards renewable energy, still relying though on nuclear power, because we kept the two big units, which are giving enough for the needs of the country. But we are not the biggest exporter.
You were, weren't you?
We were. We were for Greece, for Romania, for Turkey. For Serbia, but since we closed the four reactors, as I said, this is the situation has changed.
So, is climate change a controversial issue?
No, it's not in Bulgaria. It's not. We can we agree that we should tackle the problems of climate change.
So, where does the emissions trading scheme fit in there? I mean. And I should ask Spain the same question. Is the trading of emissions seen as an economically feasible or a productive way of dealing with the issue?
Well, Bulgaria is not a big economy. I mean, we are actually selling the quotas that we have for the emission.
Well, that's a benefit for you.
Oh, it is. Yeah. It is. But because we closed most of the plants that were big emission
producers.
Yeah. And as I said, a lot of our energy is produced by water powered stations. And we have a few which are on coal, but they are usually switched on when there is a need for that. So, definitely, in Bulgaria, there is unanimous opinion that there is climate change should be tackled, and renewable energy should be developed. We are trying now by the seaside, experimenting with windmills, wind power stations, and electrovoltaic, but I think that we still will rely on nuclear power for the future.
In our case, overall, climate change is an issue, of course, but the scheme is already there.
And, the ETS, how's it working as far as Spain is concerned?
Well, people are selling and buying credits and so on, and it's functioning well as far as I know. I mean, I'm not very well informed about that, but I think that the scheme functions fairly well. The fact of opening the scheme to others, countries who don't belong to the European Union, we find it absolutely normal in the sense that for the same reason that we have programs in the European Union that in principle were envisaged only for the European Union, member countries, like, for example, the big research and development programs. For the same reason, it will be also for the benefit of the European Union member states and for the European Union research and innovation effort to have third countries like Australia, Switzerland, Norway, name it. I mean, Japan, the United States, participating also in the in these programs. So, for the same reason, I see that it's a very good idea to have Australia participating in our scheme. Eventually, we also hope to be able in the future to come here to Australia to buy also some credits.
So my understanding is that that's indeed part of the scheme. Of course, there still has to be a formal agreement between the EU and Australia to actually put this into practice. But I understand it's not only to permit Australian businesses to purchase credits in Europe, but vice versa in 2 or 3 years beyond the Australian scheme.
So when you were ambassador to 2006-2009, the ETS was being discussed there. Did you? Was there any particular report you had to send back to Australia?
Well, certainly the ETS in Europe was looked at as a potential model, and I think clearly there were lessons to be learned from that. But also, just to take up Enrique's earlier point and your own about the importance of renewable energy in Spain, in Europe generally, but let me just focus on the bilateral element of it in Spain. One of the important sectors in which Spanish companies have invested heavily in Australia is indeed renewable energy. The largest wind farm in the southern hemisphere is one that has been developed by a Spanish company in Australia. Spanish companies have invested heavily also in things like, you mentioned, dry climate conditions, desalination plants in Western Australia.
So we're tilting at Spanish windmills, aren't
we? Are indeed. I think that when we speak of Spain, as you yourself alluded to earlier, we tend to stereotype. It's much more than flamenco and tapas and Don Quixote. It's a substantial country and a substantial relationship. Renewable energy is one element of it. Defence cooperation is another. It may come as a surprise that we're buying $13 billion worth of ships from the Spanish shipbuilder Navantia. So it's quite a diverse relationship, notwithstanding the current economic difficulties as perceived from here.
Well, as we speak tonight, our Prime Minister is in the Cook Islands for the Pacific Islands Forum. And while Australia is the major supplier of development assistance, in our discussion before tonight, it was pointed out to me that the European Union is the second, which is interesting because there's also another discussion, I suppose, as a way to put it, that the Chinese are interested in development assistance, see it in a strategic, perhaps in a strategic perspective. People may be surprised to think that the EU is such a big donor nation in the South Pacific. Maybe if I could start with you, Chris Amir, why is that? Why is Europe interested in the South Pacific?
Well, I don't think that, as you mentioned, the EU has any strategic interests in the Pacific, and that's why it is allocating so much for this region. I think this comes from the policy of the European Union to, when it can, to help countries and regions in need. So, obviously, and because I'll make a connection with the climate change here, because the climate change is affecting very heavily, especially this part of the world, the Pacific Islands. I think that the European Union is allocating this help for the countries of this region to help them overcome the negative consequences of the climate change. I don't think that there are any strategic interests in this help in the region.
Well, I can add here that Europeans have been around the Pacific since the last 4 or 5 centuries. I mean,
you only have to look at the room to see
that. We have an historical interest here.
Yeah, we do.
And many of the Pacific Island states in the Pacific were British or French colonies France is present, very much present in the Pacific. We were present in the Pacific until the independence of the Marianas and Philippines, and I mean there is an historic presence here, which I think somehow make it necessary for us, for the European Union and member states, spending half of the development cooperation effort in the world, half of it, that a share will be also focused on the Pacific, particularly because, as Casimir said, there are countries in need. Probably the small countries, archipelagic countries, may be facing even more difficulties in terms of Millennium Development Goal assistance than countries in Africa, for example, because the problems and the situation are worse. And for this reason, I mean, for many years, the European Union has had this ACP scheme dealing with Africa, Caribbean, and the Pacific countries, and it's a long, long history. And for this reason, I mean, we are spending a lot of money in development cooperation through the European Union budget, but also bilaterally with our own agencies of development cooperation. And here, I mean, we have a big interest in trying to gain of the experience of Australia, which is, I mean, the superpower of the region, in order that we could work together and we can learn from the closer experience of the Australians, in order sometimes even to implement some projects through the Australian Agency of Development Cooperation. And for the same reason, I think that the European Union and our agencies are open to implement some projects of Australia elsewhere in the world where we are more active, like in Africa or in Latin America, for example.
I think that's a very important point that Enrique's just made, and this is yet another element in the thesis that I'm pushing, that it's indeed a relationship that is evolving every day. It makes practical sense, this concept of aid delegation of the EU, which is the greatest single donor as a bloc, and its relationship with the small countries of the Pacific, that Australia, as Enrique said, be used more and more as an implementor, just as, in reverse, it makes sense for us as a not such a major donor in Africa, for example, to channel some of our aid budget to the EU, which has significantly more experience in terms of implementation in that continent. So this is just another element, another facet of cooperation between Australia and the EU that is developing as an element of the future, if you will.
Before I throw over to the room for the discussion, maybe to finish this part of discussion tonight, I take it, and I've been listening carefully, that clearly Bulgaria and Spain believe that the euro and the European Union are here to stay. Can it rival the emerging superpowers of certainly China and maybe India down the track, or are its best days behind it?
We have to be very conscious of our limitations. Europe population at the beginning of the 20th century was, roughly speaking, 60% of the world population. Mm. 50% of world population. Whereas, with the present trend of population development, in 2060, will be barely 6% of the world population, people living in Europe. So you see that there's a big gap. Of course, this takes into account that in other parts of the world, population is increasing and the richness of many, many countries is getting up. This will evolve as the world is evolving. You know? I'm confident that the European Union will continue with its integration process. There are already plans in the short term to go into that direction, not only in the European Monetary Union, which is a need given the crisis. We are impelled to move forward, because otherwise we may fall apart but also in some other sectors. I'm very happy to see only a couple of days that Angela Merkel, the German Chancellor, has called up for a working group in order to start discussing once again of a new political treaty of the European Union. This will be a fantastic opportunity to try once again to speak about foreign policy, to discuss once again the External Action Service, to speak about these energy issues I was saying before, to speak about the European Monetary Union, the euro, to speak about defense, and so many issues. And here, I mean, perhaps it's another matter for discussion is that, of course, in Lisbon, we accepted to work, of course, as much as possible as a group, 27, 28 countries with Croatia soon. But the more complex we enter into different policies, and the euro is one of them, we have to work as circles, because there are some member countries who are not willing to cooperate. So, for example, with the problems of the EMU, countries like Poland, for example, who seem to be very, very, very much for the euro, now it's more reluctant to enter in the short term. Sweden, for example, with a divided population with the euro, now it's more reluctant to enter. So countries will have to make their choices. Whenever we move toward this renowned cooperation, like the Schengen, like euro, and it will be up to the countries to adhere, to accede to these new policies.
Well, Krasimir, as one of the newest members of the EU, do you believe as the newer and less prosperous nations settle into it, that in fact Europe has the potential to has the potential to be even richer in all its constituent parts going forward?
I think yes. I think yes. This is, I will say that this is a project that a lot has been invested in this project in terms of hope and belief of hundreds of millions of people that they can live peacefully together in a prosperous Europe. And as Enrique said, the political idea was the foundation stone from the very beginning of the European Union. So I am convinced, and the latest talks about the future of the Union confirm that the Union will continue with its integration. Yesterday, Herman Van Rompuy, the President of the European Council, named for the four blocks for the future of the of the European Union. These are banking union, fiscal union, economic union, and political union. So the road is clear before us, and quite definitely in. To go to the other question, that in 10 years' time we'll see maybe definitely changed European Union, but with less, I'm certain that with less gaps between the old members and the, let's call them peripheral members.
Thank you very much. It's an optimistic note for us. We have very quick 5 minutes, so if anyone would like to make a comment.
I'm Adam Edwards from the ANU Law School. The chairman of the IMF, the International Monetary Fund, a few months ago made a comment that I had been pushing for a long while, that if the Greek people had been paying their taxes, Greece probably wouldn't be in as bad a situation as they were. Ultimately, she got shot down in flames, and which was pretty poor. But I think it's just... Is it just that the cash economy in some of these southern European countries allow for tax evasion and perhaps are making things worse than the situation should be if everybody paid their taxes?
Okay, well, we'll go straight to Southern Europe.
Yeah, yes, well, indeed, I'm not an economist myself, but I know that in my country, at least, it is calculated, this grey zone of the economy, so services that are not being taxed and these sort of things, and people working actually without papers and so on, illegal immigrants and so on, as amounting to around 20% of the economy, which is quite high. Well, this somehow is one of the reasons why we can explain why we can cope with 25% of unemployment with other reasons. In the case of Italy, in the case of Greece, perhaps it would be more or less the same. But in some other cases, like Sweden, where I served before coming here, or which is a very serious country, including taxes, or Germany, it is very difficult to calculate. Perhaps it's less. But it's a way to reducing a little bit this discussion. If they paid all taxes, perhaps things will be different.
Can I just add a rejoinder? I think what you're saying is an example of a lesson to be learned, and certainly the current crisis has its lessons to be learned. It's very easy in hindsight, of course, to say this, but the lessons are perhaps there was a certain complacency in the EU and in its member states. Perhaps there was a certain overspending, and perhaps there was a certain overlending. Perhaps there are lessons in this for Australia as well, but I think that the positive remarks that were made earlier about the road to integration, no turning back, and the recent announcements, I think at the end of June, the EU made about closer alignment of banking and tax policies, very large funds to assist problems of restructuring and unemployment, are all examples of how to address the lessons that were indeed learned over the years of complacency, overlending, and overspending.
Okay. It's to me now to thank you very much, Enrique Viguera, Krasimir Stefanov, and Noel Campbell for being our panel tonight. And obviously, we'd like to thank the ANU for hosting this function. And is this the last one for winter? Next time we have a conversation, we'll be in shorts. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.